From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. In this half hour of the program, we have a piece of fiction for you from Emily Carter. It's about a hip restaurant manager from balmy Miami who is court-ordered into rehab in freezing Minneapolis. The story is called Cold Feet, a Christmas story.
Samuel Kaminsky stalked out of the December 25th 9 a.m. gratitude meeting holiday breakfast to follow. A flush of hot righteousness initially kept him from realizing how cold a Minnesota winter could actually be. Every step he took, however, was an icy lesson in how not to dress in December. At the treatment center up north, he had spent the entire month of November inside. Besides, how exactly was a restaurateur, late of Tullio's, one of Miami's finer purveyors of fusion cuisine, supposed to know what it was like walking down an empty street in Minneapolis when single digits were dropping into the double negatives? To take his mind off the weather, Kaminsky prepared a series of explanations for his naivete. His recovery job in a downtown skyway running the blender at Juice, whose spelling was supposed to imply that you were drinking particularly pure Danish carrot pulp, had given him no inkling of what it was like outside. Since he'd been court-ordered into treatment, he'd been mostly living an indoor life. Kaminsky had never even thought about winter, beyond a dislike of the term White Christmas, which also happened to be the brand name of a particularly potent strain of freebase cocaine that had led to his presently reduced circumstances. He only knew that he had his own perfectly valid reasons for walking out of the warm little recovery circle in the church basement. First and foremost was his dislike of fat women. The women at the meeting had mostly been, by any standards, large. By South Beach standards, they were life-threateningly obese, which was particularly unnerving since he'd caught himself becoming aroused at the sight of Christine W.'s chest bouncing sloppily underneath her green and white reindeer-patterned Christmas sweater, entranced by the cheerful bobble of the reindeer's strategically placed red noses. Then there were the shoes. A collection of lumpy, dispirited-looking work boots, hideously out-of-date sneakers, and worst of all, what looked like galoshes, all leaving puddles of gray slush on the floor. Finally, there was the concept of gratitude. Should he be grateful for his room in the sober house on 16th Avenue South, a part of Minneapolis so bleak that it didn't even merit the word ghetto, since ghetto implied, at least, community, for the money he'd spent? Should he be grateful for the unrelenting, unrelieved grayness of the sky, which he'd heard on good authority lasted until the middle of May? Should he be grateful for the so-called friends that didn't call just because he'd borrowed money from them and forgotten to inform them about it? Should he be grateful for his mother who did call, not to wish him joy of the season, but to explain the lack of a Christmas check in the mail? "I can't enable you anymore, Sammy. That isn't love," he mimicked her, the simpering, mocking, wheedle male stand-up comics use when putting on a woman's voice. "Merry Christmas, Mom," he said, implying vicious air quotes around the word mom. He was just about to kick a clump of black hardened snow when he remembered his shoes, the good ones, with the butter-soft oxblood uppers and handcrafted insoles, made in a small bottega in Tuscany and available nowhere else. He thought they'd be okay with a pair of thick socks, but the air was seeping right through them and chilling his feet. No one noticed good footwear around here anyway. No one here could picture him gliding over the ceramic tiles of Tullio's entrance to greet favored customers, his footsteps nothing more than a butter-soft whisper, his hand held out, his smile full of possible transgression for the ladies and unthreatening bonhomie for the boys. He watched as he walked, how the snowflakes landed on the tops of his shoes and disappeared. His mother had failed to be impressed with his purchase, even when given its provenance. "They make your feet look small," she'd said. "Besides, who spends that kind of money on a pair of loafers?" Stamping his feet to circulate the blood back into them, Kaminsky forgot to watch where he was heading, and he lost the sidewalk, nearly walking into the sound wall that bordered 35 North. "The shortcut," he thought, recalling his sponsor Larry's favorite saying, "turns into a dead end, as usual." He observed without much interest as a car came slowly down the street, coasting as if empty or out of gas. The noise it made when it crashed into a signpost startled Kaminsky out of his dishwater-colored days, and he watched slack-jawed as a figure in bright red, its sleeves trimmed in white fake fur, came staggering out and sat down under the signpost. When he bent down to see if the man was okay, exhaust fumes of cheap vodka smacked Kaminsky's face. "Sir," he said, and touched the man's shoulder. The man answered by pulling aside his white fiberglass beard and vomiting. "Ha," he said, apparently pleased with his foresight in pulling aside the beard. Then his blue eyes rolled back in their red sockets and, looking unexpectedly comfortable, the man began to snore. Shaking him only made him swing his arms in belligerent circles. Kaminsky retreated toward the car and turned off the still-running engine, reluctantly, because he savored its warmth. The glove compartment yielded nothing more in the way of ID than an empty pint bottle of Georgie. Kaminsky's gaze snagged on a large bag in the back seat. It was full of boxes wrapped in shiny paper, each box with a name on it. Attached to the bag was a card with an unfamiliar address. Someone's Christmas party. Clearly, they'd used the wrong agency. Perhaps, Kaminsky thought, the address was for one of the gracious lakeside manors in the Kenwood area, where the kids, already sated with PlayStations and roller sneakers but still in need of entertainment, would be getting whiny and intrusive, pestering the caterer and interrupting the conversation of adults trying to sip their single malts in front of the high, many-paneled windows looking out over the lake. There would be discussion of politics and real estate deals, revenue bonds and rollovers, the things that made a city work. The men would lift their drinks with the well-lubricated motions of power-greased players, and the women would gleam in the burnished gold light of the enormous flagstone fireplace. Then the doorbell would ring, and standing there would be a young, sophisticated individual with a smile so infectious and a story so charming that one could only give him a seat by the fire, a slice of duck breast drizzled with white truffle sauce, and, upon hearing of his admittedly somewhat intimidating East Coast background, a restaurant to manage. After all, any kid who could walk a mile in those shoes and not get them ruined had to know what he was doing. In any case, why go back to the green, mildewed smell of his so-called sober house? He hoisted the sack and went to wait for a bus, walking quickly to keep the cold off and trying to avoid the patches of ice and gravel which would, he was sure, be the death of his leather shoe soles. On Franklin Avenue, the street was empty, except for a few stray crackheads, disheveled and desperate, the only sound the wind's invisible, monotonous whisper. He looked at the schedule on the bus shelter, but he didn't know what time it was, and so had no way of knowing if he had just missed a bus, one was about to arrive, or if he was stuck in between. It seemed as if he had just missed one, because the next one wasn't anywhere in sight for a long time. His feet were getting damp and chilled, the socks no protection. "Should I be grateful for my cold feet?" he muttered. His sponsor Larry's Midwestern accent poked around inside Kaminsky's head. "You should be glad you have feet. Even if they're freezing? You should be glad you're not in jail. For a few unauthorized advances? You know what they do in jail? First thing, they take your shoes." Finally, Kaminsky poked his head out of the shelter and saw, through the stinging snow, the golden headlights of the Franklin Avenue crosstown. When he held out the address, the driver darted a glance and said, "Was me, I'd take a cab." Kaminsky didn't answer. He only had enough on him for the bus fare, plus 35 cents. "Change at Hennepin," the driver went on. "Get the southbound 17 and change at 42nd for the express." Two more buses, but Kaminsky was not to be deterred, having, he had to admit, nothing else to do. Hennepin was deserted. Christmas lights blinked at no one, and the building stood silent, connected by the smoked glass tendons of skyways. It was a long 3 blocks to the next bus stop. Kaminsky checked his transfer at the shelter and calculated he had 25 minutes before the next bus arrived. He could be wrong, he thought, and stepped out to the curb to check, just as an enormous SUV rounded the corner, nearly killing him, and worse, splashing black, icy slush over his feet. his shoes sodden, the oxblood leather turned the color of burnt flesh. Kaminsky's feet began to go from aching to hurting. To keep himself from curling up inside the bus shelter, he pictured his triumphal entrance in the arched foyer, but the compassionate cooing of 100 imagined trophy wives couldn't drown out the chattering of his teeth. Kaminsky was beginning to lose the feeling in his feet. The pain was receding, replaced by a cool absence. He was shivering, almost seizure-like, no hat on his head. But even if he'd wanted to turn back, he was as far from the boarding house as he was from his destination. His teeth were clattering so loudly that he almost didn't hear the yellow cab pull up. "Okay, man, get in. Merry Christmas." Kaminsky didn't have to be asked more than once. "No money," he said. "Like I said, Mon, okay. My one good deed. Besides, is no business today at any rate." Kaminsky fell back into the intoxicating warmth of the car. It was like getting into bed after a bath, innocent, unafraid, someone coming to kiss you goodnight. The driver headed south for about 10 minutes. He wasn't sure of the address, but he told Kaminsky it was far, almost Richfield. Kaminsky wanted to inhale the heat inside the cab, wanted to tuck his feet up under him and never, never leave. Too soon, however, an unintelligible squawk came over the call box and the driver leaned over to answer it. "Okay," he said, "I've got to go to the airport, but you're very close. 5 blocks. Kaminsky checked the guy's hack license and imagined the check he would send him when he got back on his feet. The guy trying, say, to bring his mother to the States for surgery, or his kids wanting piano lessons and it looking like there was no way. Suddenly, a check arrives in the mail, signed only A. Passenger. "You're welcome," the driver said, laughing as if Kaminsky was some kind of good-natured fool for having forgotten the proper response to an act of kindness. Kaminsky began to walk. 5 blocks would have passed in a moment in South Beach, but here the blocks were long and wide, and the wind was slamming into his face. After 3 blocks, his feet inside his once beautiful shoes began to fail him, as if they were rubber things, not his at all. He stumbled and didn't even bother to turn the collar of his jacket up. He let the needles of snow prick his neck. With the sack he was carrying, he could only get one hand in his pocket at a time, so he switched the bag from side to side. This was tiring, but not tiring enough that he wasn't aware of the street he was walking down. Distinctly unpatrician, lined with mock Tudor cottages and respectable limestone bungalows. By the time Kaminsky got to the door of the house and double-checked the address, he'd abandoned his original scenario. The door would either be answered, or he would have to go from house to house begging someone to call 911. That was the situation. He leaned on the bell with his elbow. His hands were useless. After a taut elastic moment, the door swung open. A round, adult face with the unmistakable small eyes of Down syndrome shouted, "Santa's sick!" A woman's voice called out, "Let him in, please, James." Kaminsky stepped inside the small, low-ceilinged house. To the right was a living area with pleather couches, armchairs, and an old Zenith TV. The carpet was gray and everything was soothing, clean, and somehow generic. There were no knickknacks or picture frames that Kaminsky could see, no personal touches of any kind. On the couches, 4 or 5 men, all exhibiting varying degrees of mental disability, sat around in freshly laundered sweaters. They looked warm and well-fed, and at the moment, much healthier than Samuel Kaminsky. The woman's face floated toward him. "The agency said you were unreliable. They didn't say you were an idiot. What did you do? Take the bus?" Kaminsky fainted. Drifting back into consciousness, Kaminsky found himself looking at the Star of Bethlehem. It twinkled and shot out rays of light before resolving itself into a diamond nose stud on the face of the woman smiling above him. Ridiculously out of date, a nose stud. Clearly not a diamond at all. But still, he found himself drawn to its sparkle. 10 minutes later, the woman, having calmed her charges, was sitting next to him on the couch, laughing while his feet soaked in a bowl of room-temperature water. Above his head, bolted to the wall, Kaminsky was reading the rules of the house. Rule number one, it said, respect. The woman kept laughing, even when the feeling came screaming back into Kaminsky's feet, and he moaned and winced and was generally anything but cool. The woman, Linda, was not the glossy-haired creature he had imagined listening to the tale of his travels. But for some reason, perhaps because he couldn't think of one, he wasn't tempted to give her a less ridiculous explanation of his presence. Wrong neck of the woods, she giggled, when his imagined destination came tumbling against his will out of Kaminsky's mouth. Welcome to the Olsen family-style community home. Linda, James called out from the kitchen. Is Santa too sick to give presents? Some of the men looked at him. Some ignored him, rocking and humming to themselves. Kaminsky himself looked at Linda. She wore cat's eye glasses, a homemade knit cap, and of course, the extremely out-of-style nose ring. Her whole look, in fact, could be summed up in the word alternative. He and his friends had used this word with each other as a sort of code to mean loser, implying hapless guys with rock star dreams or chicks with too many tattoos and non-aerobic midriffs. But Linda's laugh had a magic log effect, instantly whooshing the room into firelit coziness. He watched as she moved around the living room picking things up. He forgot for the moment that he prided himself on dating only Brazilian actress models and was struck by a longing to make a good impression on her. Perhaps by paying her a compliment. But what? He didn't think his usual line, "Your hair looks very expensive tonight," would impress her. "You're like a server at a 5-star joint," he observed. "You can take care of 8 things at once without looking rushed." "Yeah, but I don't get paid like one," she answered. "Now waiters make some good ching." She took away a can of caffeinated soda from one of the men, saying, "3's your limit, Scott." "Anyway, do you think he could?" she asked Kaminsky. "The presents?" "I don't have a costume," Kaminsky murmured. "No problem," she said, and tossed him a hat. Kaminsky put it on, the red tail of it flopping in his eyes, the base crushing the well-moosed and individually fussed with chestnut strands of which, he had to admit, he was rather proud. He looked around at the developmentally disabled men, the mongoloids, the autistic rockers, the pudgy, strangely formed and utterly unglamorous guests at the party he had pictured all wrong. Samuel Kaminsky began to hand out presents. "Ho, ho, ho," he said. When he picked out a present, he called their name out. Sometimes they needed prompting from Linda. Sometimes they lunged at the gifts like cheerful Rottweilers after pork chops. They got 3 presents apiece, immediately discarding the socks and scars without so much as a glance. But James got a wind-up furry toy that squeaked and sent him into spasms of silent laughter. He wound it over and over again, until Linda put it away before he broke it. One guy, who resembled no one so much as Popeye, had gotten a small tape deck and some batteries. He immediately assembled it and began wrapping it with masking tape. Over this, Linda wrote in big block letters with an exclamation point at the end the name Bill. Bill hugged the cassette player to his chest, glaring, implicitly daring anyone to come and take it. Kaminsky couldn't remember when he'd seen anyone like their presence so well. Still, the entrepreneur fallen on temporarily hard times was finding reason to sulk. Linda was paying far too much attention to what she called her clients, and not quite enough, in Kaminsky's opinion, to him, who had nearly died of hypothermia as a result of his heroic efforts to bring Christmas to their humble home, asking no reward except perhaps the phone number of the home's chief of staff, who was busy throwing away wrapping paper and whose nose ring was perhaps not out of date, but merely classic. Also, although he didn't like to mention it, Kaminsky hadn't gotten a present. Not even a plate of homemade chocolate chip cookies, which was, as he understood it, within his rights to expect pursuant to his job description. "Are you bummed?" Linda looked at him, clearly amused. "Nothing for Santa?" Don't be crazy, Kaminsky said. He immediately regretted his word choice, not polite under the circumstances. I know. Scott, go into Andrew's old cubby. Here she began to whisper. Really, Kaminsky demurred, you're very... He looked for the word thoughtful. But it's totally unnecessary. But by the time he had finished his sentence, Scott had come lolloping out, holding a pair of snow boots. Kaminsky shrank. They seemed large and unruly, the linings frothing grungily over the tops, a myriad of eyelets and laces, latches and tongues, boisterously flopping around everywhere. What happened to Andrew? Kaminsky whispered. Linda whispered back, aneurysm. I don't know, he said. No, Linda assured him. You lucked out. In almost reverential tones, she added, they're Sorrells. Kaminsky dried his feet, grabbed some of the rejected socks, and tried on the boots. His feet were instantly warm. He pressed his hand over his face tightly as if the light hurt him. What are you crying for? Linda asked him. Kaminsky couldn't think of a cover. I'm crying, he said, because these are such beautiful boots.
Cold Feet, A Christmas Story, was written and read by Emily Carter. She's also the author of Glory Goes and Gets Some.